but I have to thank Paul McEnroe from the Star and Tribune for the series of articles he's been writing to bring attention to this issue. Mental health has been, throughout my career in the legislature, an important thing to me, for me to deal with, and there's just a few things I want to say by way of introduction. Thank you. I've worked in children's mental health for 4 years with Hennepin County before I got elected to the House in 2000. I have also worked with a number of programs with mental health issues and have mental health issues in my family. I am very much interested in this issue because I worked also on the deinstitutionalization study in 1985. That shows how old I am. And that's when we promised people that when we closed the state hospitals, we would have all kinds of community services available for them. We did pretty well with people with developmental disabilities, but we did not well at all for people with mental illness. So once we close those institutions, we find after almost 30 years that we have a lot of people with mental illness that are homeless, a lot of people that are spending time in jail and prisons, where if they would have either had early intervention or had diversionary services of some sort, they could have avoided, maybe avoided the criminal courts and the criminal system. We're hoping to figure out what kinds of services we need to change, turn this around. Right now, I'm hearing from the jails and the prisons that 30 to 50% of their inmates have a mental illness. That is so opposite of what it was like 30, 40 years ago. It was probably around 5%. So you can see that the problem is increasing. We are starting the day today. I want to introduce our chair, Senator Ron Latz. He has allowed me to thank you for allowing me to hold this and start talking about this issue. We won't resolve everything today, but we will hopefully get this conversation going so we can start paying attention to it. This is not just a problem in Minnesota. It's a problem countrywide. Basically, the federal government dropped the ball on the promises it made when it proposed deinstitutionalization in the 1970s and 1980s. States also dropped the ball, including Minnesota, in helping to put out support services. And when there are cuts in the budget, it seems like oftentimes that's the first place to go, or one of the first places to go. I know the program for children, the collaborative I worked in Hennepin County, went away with 4 or 5 years of good success because of the dollars were pulled from the federal government. And I see that happening in a number of programs for people with mental illness. So also we have Senator Wicklund with us today. As I said, some of our other senators are in other meetings, but I hope that this allows us to have an ongoing conversation about this issue, and very important issue, in ways that we can handle it better in the state. First on the agenda today is the Honorable Judge Jay Quam, and I welcome you to the table.
Thank you very much. You want me to go?
Yes, please. And yes, I just want to remind the testifiers to sign the sheet as they're here, as they come up to the testify. And you can do that after you're done with your testimony.
You want me to start?
Please do.
All right. Well, welcome, everyone. Thank you for letting me be here. As Senator Goodwin said, my name is Jay Quam, and I'm a judge of the Hennepin County District Court. Been on the bench for a little more than 7 years, including more than 3 years handling cases involving people with mental illness. And in those assignments, I learned a lot about mental illness. Probably the most basic but the most important thing that I learned to start out is that mental illness is a disease a lot like cancer. There's some very striking similarities. As with cancer, people with mental illness, they get struck arbitrarily without any kind of rhyme or reason. They get struck without regard to whether they're rich or poor, whether they're black or white, whether they're young or old, whether they're man or woman. And they get struck in a way that is almost always devastating, but sometimes deadly. Those are the similarities. There is a very substantial and tragic difference between those, and that is in how the community responds to someone who has mental illness versus someone who has cancer. Someone has cancer, first thing that happens is they get taken to the best treatment facility available, and they're surrounded by medical professionals. Their friends and their family are there to help pick up the needs that they have. There's Caring Bridge sites that are set up to stay in touch with them and support them however they can, and that is exactly as it should be. I don't know that we can do anything less for people who are struck with cancer. But the difference is, if you're struck with mental illness, as Senator Goodwin is saying, we don't have the resources to try to address that immediately. So the symptoms tend to emerge. And as they emerge, one of the first things that happens is that people become alienated from those they need the most, their friends and their family. And as things develop even further, they become ostracized from their community, with the end result being, in too many cases, people who live large portions of their lives under bridges, in homeless shelters, and far, far too often, and the reason we're here today, is in jails. When I look, you know, one of the most important responsibilities that I have as a judge is to protect the sick, the helpless, and the needy. And when I see the number of people with mental illness who live lives that are unnecessarily broken, painful, and short, I feel like I and everyone else who has that responsibility has failed that responsibility. And this is not a session to try to shame all of us. I think we just have to take inventory of where we are. And where we are, I think, is looking at a situation that we failed generally, but I think we failed probably most significantly in the way we have allowed our jails to become basically the dumping ground for our mentally ill. And that failure is evident in the fact that our largest mental health care facilities in the country are the Los Angeles County Jail, the New York Jail, and the Cook County Jail. The failure is obvious in the fact that, and this relates to a fact that you threw out, Senator Goodwin, that there are now 10 times more mentally ill people in jail cells than there are in treatment beds. And that failure is evident in the fact that someone who's brought to jail will spend, on average, 8 times more time in jail if they're mentally ill than someone who does not have a mental illness. That is all very unfair. And like I said, this is not a session to just complain about how we got here or why we got here. The session is to decide how we're going to make things better. And there are things that we can do to make things better for those with mental illness. Clearly, there's some community solutions that have to be arrived at. One of the reasons that so many people come to jail is because there's no place else to put them. So the solutions outside of the criminal justice system go hand in hand with the solutions within the criminal justice system. And there's a lot of different things. A couple of things I'm going to suggest are what we can and should do to help the system work better so that it deals with the people more effectively and it deals with them more efficiently and it deals with them in a way that allows them to get treatment faster are these. You know, first of all, look at the people when they come into the justice system. Right now, the jails will gather some information, but they are there to observe the behavior 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And they gather a lot of very important information about people's mental status. And you know what happens to most of that information as far as getting them the treatment they need, getting the criminal justice system to operate as it should? Just about nothing. And that's because there's no formal mechanism for taking the information that the jail already has and delivering that to people like me, judges who have a responsibility to deal with people with mental illness, prosecutors, defense lawyers, or even treatment professionals outside of the jail. So the first thing I would suggest is we allow that information to be used to take the actions that are necessary to appropriately address that person's needs. Second thing, and this relates to the people that probably don't number greatly, but they are the most problematic folks, people with very acute mental illnesses. As it is now, we've got a one-size system that fits all. Sooner or later, someone identifies a person who comes through the system as being mentally ill, and you start this thing called the Rule 20 process. Rule 20 process plays itself out. And the only thing that happens, if there's a finding that the person is so mentally ill that they're incompetent, is you start another process. and that's the commitment process that you probably know about. There's the potential to combine the examination, but as a practical matter, no matter how symptomatic the person is, it takes 6 weeks to 2 months to get from start to finish, finish being the point where someone finally gets the treatment that they need. What I would suggest is in the most acute situations where just about anybody looking at the person would say, we know where this person is going to end up, and that is, you know, committed, getting the treatment that they need. What I would suggest is that you allow the whole system to be fast-tracked or collapsed, if you will, so that you can have one examination, you can have one hearing that addresses both the competency issue and the committability issue, and you get that person, if they are committable, you get them committed within a week or two rather than a month or two. And if they're not, at least you know that. But having that collapse, and this would be upon agreement of all the parties, is something I think that has a lot to be in support of. And honestly, as I sit here, I can't think of any reason why we wouldn't do it. So that's the second one, is to collapse the system in appropriate cases. A third one, you know, relates to this part we were talking about, the sequential nature of the Rule 20 proceedings. Minnesota is one of the very, very few states in the country that has that system. I hate to say that we're behind Arkansas, Alabama, Mississippi on just about anything, but we are on that. And what I would suggest is that we look at other states and look what they do and adopt the best practices that they have. And here's what I would suggest that they are, although it maybe takes some refinement. And that is that once someone is found to be incompetent, so they've come through the criminal justice system and they've been determined to have a mental illness that interferes with their ability to go forward, what most states do and what I would suggest we do is to allow them to be treated and assessed for a short period, 60 days, something like that, to really get a handle on what their mental illness is. Most states find that, you know, in that short period of time, people are brought back to competency, they can deal with their criminal case, and they can get on with their lives. Others are more problematic. It's not everyone's going to be so easily addressed. Others, if necessary, within that two-month period, three-month period, you'll get a sense of what they really need. You know, is it just more treatment and a stable environment? For a shorter period of time, or is it commitment? At that point, you can make a much more intelligent choice about what's the right path to deal with this person's mental health needs. We don't have that now, but I think we should. And the fourth thing I'll mention, and then I'll sit down and turn it over to my colleagues, and that is that once someone has gone through the system as it exists today, they finally get committed. And one of the problems you addressed last year, which I applaud you for, was the time it took to get the people from jail to treatment. That was a very important step and a very necessary step. One of the issues that we have now is getting them out of treatment. I don't know if Commissioner or Assistant Commissioner Barry will be here. If she is, she'll probably tell you or confirm that they have a very big problem getting people out of St. Peter or out of Anoka once they're competent. And what I understand the timing to be is once someone is good to go, as far as they can tell, it takes typically 2 months, oftentimes 6 months, to get them out of that bed and into either the criminal justice system to deal with their crime or to get them out of the community. And that's a very expensive bed that somebody else needs. And there's a whole bunch of explanations why it can take that long. None of them, if you would ask me, are legitimate at all. And what I would suggest you consider is doing what you did last year, but on the back end of this, and say, once someone is deemed to be competent and that report is filed, they must have their case heard within a reasonable time period. And we'll probably squawk a little bit about how hard it's going to be to accommodate that deadline. None of that will be legitimate, and we will figure out a way to get people back into court to address their needs in the way that they deserve to have them addressed. So those are the things that I have. There's a lot more we could talk about, but I think it's a good place to begin the discussion. And I want to say, as Senator Goodman suggested, this was a problem that was decades in the making. I hope it's not decades in the fixing, but it's not going to be an easy fix. I didn't take my job because all I wanted was the easy stuff. I hope that you will join the group here, other people interested in the issue, to work together to try to find the solutions that have been long time coming and very well deserved for the mentally ill.
Thank you so much, Judge. Does anybody have questions for Judge Quam?
Yeah.
Senator Latz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Judge, welcome to
thank
the committee.
You.
We had a some of us from the committee had a tour this morning sitting in the mental health court in Hennepin County, the specialized court. What exactly is your role in Hennepin County in the courts? Are you in the probate
no.
bench? Or?
I was. It's a little confusing. If you go over to Hennepin County and they say, and you say, I'd like to go to the mental health court, they will say, which mental health court? The mental health court you went to was better defined as the criminal mental health court. And that is, if you're familiar with problem-solving courts, it is the problem-solving court within the criminal context that helps people with mental illness manage their mental illness, you know, really through the potential criminal sanctions that come out of this. I wasn't in there. I was in the mental health commitment court. So what I would see day in and day out, really, are people that have gone through the criminal system. They were too severely ill to be put into the criminal mental health court, you know, because they were incompetent. They were ones who were they were ill enough to be considered for commitment. And now what I am is I'm in the serious felony area. So I see people who are mentally ill as they come in, even before they get to the criminal mental health court or the commitment.
And then there's, Madam Chair, and then there's that group of people who are found they're not mentally
yep.
ill enough
yep.
to be incompetent,
yes.
but they're still not
committable.
Qualifying. They're not committable.
Yeah.
And they don't really qualify necessarily for any of the specialized courts either. And then
right.
there are some that may be found incompetent, but they're also not committable, and because the crimes that they've committed
right.
Make them not dangerous to themselves or others to satisfy the commitment criteria, and then they're kind of left in total legal limbo.
Can I speak to that just for a moment, Senator Goodwin?
Yeah.
What Senator Latz is talking about is what I touched upon as far as the Rule 20 process that we have. It really is a creature of a different day that isn't suited for the work that we need to have done here. So if someone comes into the criminal justice system, they cannot be prosecuted unless they are competent. Competent is generally the ability to understand the legal proceedings and the ability to effectively interact with your lawyer. That's the standard for being competent. In Minnesota, if you do not meet that standard, so you're incompetent, the law says, well, what we'll do is we'll refer you over for potential commitment. And you probably are all familiar enough with the commitment law, but it's a different standard. There has to be clear and convincing evidence that there's a very serious degree of danger likely as a result of the mental illness. And the individuals that Senator Latz is referring to are the ones that come in really surprisingly large numbers through the criminal justice system. They have a serious mental illness, but they're not necessarily going to go out and hurt somebody. You know, they're the ones that have got the livability crimes that they commit over and over and over again. And the way our system is set up now, I'd say roughly half of the people that are found incompetent do not make it through the whole commitment proceedings. The result is that they drop through this gap that Senator Latz referred to, and you can't prosecute them, you can't treat them, and they go back into the community, and you imagine untreated engaging in that type of behavior. Doesn't take that long to get them back in the community. I mean, I think there was one guy, Senator Latz, that it took roughly 45 minutes from the time he left the jail door because he fell through this Rule 20 commitment gap to the time he is arrested and brought back in. You know, typically it doesn't happen that fast, but that is the type of phenomenon that happens when you've got this big gap that we have in Minnesota's Rule 20 process.
Thank you. Any other questions for Judge Quam? Thank you, Judge.
And thank you.
You're gonna be around for a while?
Yeah, no, I'll stay around. I'm
okay.
kind of interested in this, so
great.
I'm curious to see what everyone else has to say. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you. Next on the agenda is Sheriff Stenick.
Madam Chair, if it's okay, I'm going to ask my Ramsey County colleague to join me as well.
Oh, certainly. Great. By the way, that's not Bigfoot coming in. That's work on the Capitol.
The judge's drumbeat.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry, Judge. That was mean. Hey, good afternoon. My name is Rich Stanek, and I'm the sheriff of Hennepin County. First off, I want to thank you, Senator Goodwin. I had a chance to talk to you before the hearing. I really appreciate you taking the time and, you know, bringing this committee together. And Senator Latz, thank you as well for allowing that to happen. This is an important issue in our criminal justice system. Kudos to Judge Quam. He has been absolutely remarkable to work with. We're very fortunate over in the 4th District to have someone of his caliber and his passion working on this day in and day out. He's a real-life practitioner. As a judge sitting on the bench, he sees it. He can articulate it. And we really, really appreciate that. You know, in the Hennepin County Sheriff's Office, we've been focusing much time and effort over the last couple of years reviewing the issues of mental illness and our criminal justice system, as you all have as well. All of this in an effort to prevent our local jails from continuing to be, as Judge put it, the largest mental health facility in our state. Jails are not the place to treat those who suffer from mental illness, pure and simple. Last legislative session, as the judge pointed out, we worked with the legislature to pass a bill requiring a transfer out of county jails to a mental health facility within 48 hours after judicial order for civil commitment, and that was a good thing. Prior to this law being enacted, we were seeing inmates being held on an average of 7 to 10 days or longer after the court order had been issued. And since this bill has passed, all the transfers in my county, with the exception of one, have occurred within the 48-hour time frame. And that one didn't occur within the time frame, but that was mutual consent of and some transport reasons. In fact, I saw a letter by Deputy Commissioner Berry outlining that to the committee, and she's right on with that. We appreciate her help as well. This 48-hour bill made a difference, but it was just one of the pieces of the puzzle, as I said last year, or I guess earlier this year when I was before this committee. There are many issues that remain, some of which the judge has outlined. Now, we need to make sure that those who need mental health treatment are getting it and not languishing for long periods of time in our jails. As the sheriff of Hennepin County, I'm responsible for the operation of the largest jail in Minnesota in the upper Midwest, the Hennepin County Public Safety Facility, and every year we book approximately 38,000 people through those front doors. You had estimated, Madam Chair, to the committee that anywhere from, I think you said 30 to 50%, including jails and our state prisons nationally. I can tell you within Hennepin County, we estimate about 25 to 30% of them suffer from mental illness, treated or untreated. And that's according to a 2006 study done by the U.S. Department of Justice. And oftentimes, our jail staff must operate as the frontline mental health workers, and it is a challenge for them day in and day out. People who suffer from mental illness require far more resources than the average inmate. A couple for instances. The risk of suicide among mentally ill jail inmates is far higher than those amongst the average population. And the Sheriff's Office has won a national award for our mental illness training program for detention staff, and I know other facilities across state, including my friends in Ramsey County, do likewise. Yet even with these best practices in place, we know that a jail is not the best place for someone with a mental illness. Instead, they should be receiving psychiatric treatment in a more appropriate setting, such as state psychiatric facility or community-based treatment. But it's been taking too long to get them there. Those with mental illness are spending too much time in our local jails. In 2012, we had approximately 30 inmates committed to the custody of the Department of Human Services. Now, they were determined to be mentally ill and a danger to themselves and or others. And this 48-hour transfer law that took effect earlier this year helped once a commitment order was issued by the judge. But an inmate can still be waiting for months before that even happens. An example, in one case from Hennepin County, it took 15 months from the date of arrest to the date the inmate was transferred from St. Peter to St. Peter for inpatient treatment. 15 months. Let's just say his name was John Doe. He was arrested and booked in the Hennepin County Jail on April 8th of 2010, and he was charged with 5 felonies, including attempted murder in the first degree. Almost a year later, on March 17th of 2011, he was determined to be incompetent to stand trial due to mental illness. He then waited in jail for another 3 months for further psychological evaluations and hearings until, on June 21st of 2011, he was committed to the custody of the Department of Human Services as mentally ill and dangerous, and then transferred to St. Peter for inpatient treatment. The court's medical expert concluded that his behavior is dangerous when his condition is not treated. We do not treat in a local jail. Yet he sat in the jail, which is not a mental health treatment facility, for 15 months for the whole process to work before he was placed in appropriate treatment. Because of the jail environment, many of these inmates find their mental health conditions get worse. Exasperate. Those with mental illness should not languish in our jails for weeks or even months waiting for the proper care. We need to find a way to make this a quicker process, and we have a few ideas for you if you are up for it. Madam Chair, members, one solution brought forward last year by Senator Ortman is Senate File 685, and that would combine the incompetency and civil commitment evaluations for certain individuals when all parties are in agreement. We had, you know, discussion about this back and forth. This has the potential to save weeks of the inmate waiting in jail while yet another evaluation process is undertaken and the inmate continues to decompensate. Just like the 48-hour bill I talked about earlier, Senate File 685 is not the full solution. We understand that. But it will help to ensure people who need mental health treatment are getting mental health treatment and not languishing in jail for long periods of time. You know, we in law enforcement continue to work with others to seek additional solutions. In fact, over this last week, my staff has been meeting with Judge Quam and others on legislative proposals that can improve the process, again, some of which he articulated earlier this afternoon. As we refine these proposals, we're going to look forward to the input of stakeholders such as NAMI, you know, public defenders, our county attorneys, the Department of Health and Human Services, and others. Now, I look forward to the ongoing policy discussion and your consideration of these important issues. And I thank you, Senator and committee members, for the time you've given me this afternoon.
Thank you so much, Chair.
Good afternoon, Senators. I'm David Matusalem, Undersheriff of the Ramsey County Jail. We have very similar types of facilities and a similar demographic we serve as that of Hennepin County. We have a 500-bed pretrial facility. We book in about 22,000 people a year, and they stay on an average of 5 days. We have been experiencing much of the same increase everyone's talking about. In the last 10 years, our number of Rule 20 hearings has quadrupled. At any given time, we're seeing that same 25% to 30% people that are suffering serious mental illness problems and many of those on psychoactive medications. Challenges this creates, there are several. Some of them relate to housing. One of the things we do notice what's difficult for our staff and for the inmates is that inmates with serious mental health issues, particularly those with delusion, agitation, or severe and persistent mental illness, a jail cell is probably the worst place for them. It actually elevates things and makes things worse, it seems like. The assessment and treatment capacity are really limited in the facility. One of the things Judge Quam mentioned was that possibly like a 60-day period for more assessment to bring people back to competency. What we see is that a lot of times when people are booked in that are suffering from mental illness, for one reason or another, either they haven't had a comprehensive enough assessment or diagnosis to receive proper treatment, or for whatever variety of factors, they're not taking their medication at the time they come into custody, so that initial snapshot isn't necessarily where we could get with the proper assessment and treatment during those initial periods in jail. And the final thing is really when people talk about the going back to the community and what resources are available, part of that connectivity from the jail to the community of how we make sure that we're doing what we can while a person's in custody so that they're accessing those resources when they get out. Some of that release planning of connecting the family and the services that are on the outside are things that we really see that could be bolstered and we'd be hoping to do. So those are some of our recommendations that I worked into kind of what we're seeing. And you have any questions?
Members, any questions? Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ann Berry?
Madam Chair?
If I just may ask Sheriff Stanek, I was unable to join the tour of the jail facility last week. I wonder if at some point I could contact you just to get a quick view, especially of the SEG area, where I understand a lot of the mentally ill residents of the jail are kept.
Yeah, okay? Madam Chair, members, in Senator Latz, I mean, we'd love to have you come back. So I'll have Sandra work with your staff to help set it up. Senator, members, if any of you want to come take a trip, visit, please, we're happy to accommodate. We'll work around your schedules and appreciate that.
Thank you.
Like that. Thank you very much. Also, I want to say that I visited the Ramsey County Jail three, 4 weeks ago, and they're very good showing me the mental health program and all the changes that have occurred to accommodate people with mental illness at the jail. I think that they have some real innovative, very innovative things that they're doing, trying to follow through too after people leave the jail. And I'd like to see some of those same kinds of programs that you're doing there transferred into a community setting for aftercare, because I do believe that that program is probably one of the most innovative things I've seen so far. And I didn't get to the Hennepin County Jail yet, but I certainly did get to the mental health court and was impressed with that as well. So it's just very interesting to me when you look at the big picture, how much work everybody has to do because of these dramatic changes in what people in your occupations used to do, to what kind of training and what kind of things you need to do now. So thank you very much for your work.
Madam Chair, members, just real brief. I had a chance to meet with Governor Dayton a week or so ago. We talked about this very issue in depth. He understands it. He gets it. What I told you today is what I told him sitting at his table. I hope that he'll be a partner working with this Senate and the legislature to, you know, try and figure out what we can do from our side and law enforcement in order to get these folks the treatment that they need. We are not particularly shy. We're law and order kind of guys. Make no mistake about it. But there's a right and there's a wrong way to go about doing this. And those that suffer from mental illness need the treatment. We cannot provide that treatment to them. So we're looking for your help, the governor's help, the House, to be able to do that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Happy holidays.
Thank you very much. Commissioner Ann Berry. Deputy Commissioner Berry, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Ann Berry. I'm the Deputy Commissioner with the Minnesota Department of Human Services and was asked to provide the committee with an update on where we are with the 48-hour rule, as it's now being called, that was implemented last session, and the department began operating under that requirement, I believe, in August of last year. On a monthly basis, on a quarterly basis, we report to Hennepin County Court on how we are doing with the 48-hour rule, and you have data in front of you that shows you that in all but three cases, we've been able to place people in our facility within 48 hours, and those few exceptions have been within, I think, 59 or 60 hours of the actual commitment by the court. It doesn't get at the issues that Judge Quam and Sheriff Stanek have raised, which are the length of time it takes for the commitment to take place. But once committed to the Commissioner of Human Services, we have followed through on our commitment to move people into our facilities within 48 hours. Just two other things. There are certainly consequences to that. It means that other people who are waiting in maybe community hospitals, Hennepin County, maybe other places, Hennepin County Medical Center, who are put down the priority list some so that we can move people from jail. We agreed last session that it was the right thing to do, and we continue to agree that it's the right thing to do. And second, I want to pick up on a point that was made by Judge Quam, which is on any given day, almost 40% of the people at our facility at Anoka, not as many at St. Peter, no longer need to be with us. They have met the treatment requirements and no longer need that level of care. I've said this to Senator Sharon in her committee as well, and I'll say it again today. We need to find additional community resources so that people can be served, so that they don't move in and out of systems in crisis, so that they get that support on a regular basis. And we're prepared and ready to work with you and with counties and everyone else involved in the development of that system.
Thank you, Deputy Commissioner. I have one question, then I'm going to ask the committee. What kind of services with the population, the people that you have at Anoka and St. Peter, maybe particularly Anoka, what kind of services would you be able to, if you had them, would you be able to release people from? Because I have heard that people stay way too long at Anoka or whatever. Is like crisis services or aftercare crisis services or somebody to follow through with them? Or are you lacking places to send them, housing, opportunities, or what kinds of things are you talking about exactly?
Well, Madam Chair, in your question there, you raised a number of the kind of services that we would need to put together at the county level to provide the right kind of aftercare based on what the client needs. But it includes housing with the right kind of supervision, and making sure, you know, it's more than just monthly case management. It is potentially a peer specialist. It is somebody whose responsibility it is to make sure that a person who needs medication is taking medication, is interacting with others in the most integrated kind of way. I mean, it's the kind of services we provide to people with physical disabilities and developmental disabilities and people who are elderly, and it is again just enough so that people have that kind of support and know that there's somebody there who is looking out for their interests. There are states that use Medicaid waivers to provide those kinds of services. We certainly could get into that kind of discussion if you'd like to, but they're all the things you listed in your question.
Thank you very much. Any questions from the members?
Madam Chair.
Senator Latz.
Commissioner, I thought several decades ago we moved into a deinstitutionalization mode to try to move people out of the state hospitals and into community services. Have we just not gone far enough, or what's your take on that?
Madam Chair and Senator,
yes.
I would, as somebody who started my career working at a state institution over 30 years ago, and that moved toward deinstitutionalization, we clearly provided a set of services, community-based services for people with physical disabilities and developmental disabilities. We began to develop that system for people with mental health issues, but those systems don't look exactly the same. I think most people would suggest that the models that we use for people with developmental disabilities, which are also beginning to change today, those very highly congregated kind of models, need to continue to evolve and change and should serve people with mental health issues as well. You know, we didn't replace bed for bed or service for service in the community, and I'm not sure that's what we needed to do because we really wanted to be in the business of prevention, you know, getting way upstream and serving people long before they needed to be institutionalized. But in that process, there clearly aren't enough places where people can live where they'll get that kind of support and supervision so that they don't move in and out of a crisis system.
Thank you. I skipped over and didn't mean to. This direct line staff from the Department of Corrections, and that would be John Soul and let's see if I got all the right names here. No, Shane Warnke? Okay, thank you. All right. I think we'll start with Mr. Warnke. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
That's correct.
Thank you.
First off, I'd like to thank you, Madam Chair, as well as members of the committee for having us here to speak. This is something that I hold very true. I participated in CIT training. October of 2012 is when I graduated.
Do you want to tell us what that is, please?
Yeah, I'll get into that. Thank you. Crisis intervention training. Basically, we have an outside agency come in and teach us every dynamic that I can think of, different mental illnesses, how to deal with them, prescription medications that people with these illnesses take, as well as actors that come in and actually act out and depict individuals with these illnesses. So I took this week-long course, Minnesota Department of Corrections, MCF Stillwater, graduated. We have a graduation ceremony, certificate and what have you. Graduated October 5th from that course. A week later to the day, I was working routine hospital coverage down at St. Joseph's Hospital, which is our contract hospital for the department. And I was the officer in charge that night. We had approximately five or six offenders down there. pretty busy night when you're having to run around, provide coverage for medical procedures as well as get your officers out on break and whatnot. About 5 minutes prior to going to a procedure, I was approached by a nurse who was in a very frantic state, saying they had a situation down the hall about five rooms down from where I was at. Now, this wasn't involving an offender. This was involving a civilian patient. Not knowing what was going on at that moment, I went down to the room, was briefed by the nursing staff, told me the patient had a weapon and had cut himself out of his hospital bed. Was able to peer my head in the door to see that there was a staff member laying on the ground. Patient had a scissors to the staff member's throat, told me not to come any closer or he was going to stick the staff member. Having had this training, it was still fresh in my mind. I knew exactly what I had to do at that point in time. There was no question. I immediately went right into what I had just learned a week prior to that. I addressed the patient by his first name, which is typically something in corrections we don't do. We typically don't address offenders by their first names, except when it comes to utilizing the CIT training, because when you address somebody by their first name, it brings it to a more personal level. They're able to respond to you better. Instead of Offender Jones, Offender Johnson, hey, James, hey, Chris, that is something right away that I did with this. The patient immediately focused his attention on me and kind of let up off the nurse on the floor, nursing assistant it was. He made two borderline attempts to come at me with the weapon. Didn't full-out attack me, but kind of made, you know, hesitant lunge movements. I was able to, in approximately 2 minutes' time, talk the individual into surrendering the weapon. Or actually, before that, letting the hostage go, then surrendering the weapon. Just like anything else, it seemed like it took forever. It was literally 2 minutes in time. This CIT training is crucial for jail officers, detention officers, as well as Department of Correctional officers. These are all tools that we have in the tool. It basically is tools for the toolbox. It's stuff that we know, but it puts it everything together, puts it in perspective. You know, empathy is something that I really learned through this training. So oftentimes there'd be a guy acting up, an offender acting up, and we would just, you know, without even really trying to get to the root of the problem, we would just respond. It's so much easier in our shoes that you use a little empathy. The person's usually got something on their mind. They want to know that you understand what they're saying. And by that, I mean, one thing that I like to do is I like to speak back. You know, the person tells me, well, I haven't been able to call, you know, my daughter. It's her birthday. Something simple to us means a lot to somebody that's incarcerated. Being able to be empathetic, repeat back what they're saying in, you know, like our words versus verbatim to what they're saying, really helps the situation. And that's something that I learned through training. And I know a lot of my coworkers at work, the same thing. You know, we have all these illusions, but then you put it all in perspective through the CIT training, and it all of a sudden makes more sense. We have a lot less injuries. We have a lot, you know, being able to talk to people. It's just, it's a really great program.
Thank you very much. Mr. Soul, did you want to add to that?
Thank you for having me here. I would agree with Sheriff Stanek. Prison, jails is not an environment to promote any kind of psychological change. I often tell people about where I work, that I work in the worst neighborhood you can. And by that I mean, there's some neighborhoods you might think about carrying some car mace, walking out with a friend to your car, maybe leaving before dark. These are all parts of bad neighborhoods. Some neighborhoods you don't even have to see a threat, you feel it. Just get out of your car. Those elements, all those bad elements, are many of the people that end up in jails and prisons. Okay, so essentially, my neighborhood, the neighborhood I work in and the inmates live in, is the worst possible neighborhood you could live in. Now, you take a very vulnerable, mentally ill person, immerse them into a jail or correctional facility where these people, by nature, are predators. This is what they do. It's no place to promote change. We can try and protect the safety of staff and offenders, but that's very difficult in a very bad neighborhood. One of my jobs as a corrections officer is I drive offenders to hospitals. I don't know how many I've driven to have rape case tests done to them. It's a reality. It's a reality that we're addressing the Prison Rape Elimination Act. But the most vulnerable, the weakest, will be the first that these very dangerous people that live in this very bad neighborhood will prey on. That's about all I have to say.
Thank you. Did either of you two want to testify?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Terry Carlson. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Facilities Division. And I just wanted to say, first of all, on behalf of Commissioner Tom Roy, to these two, thank you for the great work that you do and for being here with us today to talk about your experiences. It's hard work in these prisons, and we do our best to minimize violence that happens in our facilities and to promote positive change. That certainly is our mission, to reduce recidivism, reduce the numbers of people who come back to prison by, you know, strategies of safety and also programs that will promote offenders to make meaningful changes in their lives. And it is very challenging. Our prison population does continue to grow, and we intake about 7,000 folks into our facilities every year, and about the same amount get out. And we need to focus our resources in our prison on the highest risk, highest need offenders. And Nan Larson is here and is going to provide a little bit of information about our mental health services in our facilities. But what I wanted to just tell you for a few minutes is that when an offender comes into one of our intake facilities, St. Cloud for the men, Shakopee for the women, we spend time doing assessments on those offenders to determine their needs. We do physical, medical kinds of assessments, mental health assessments, educational assessments, assessments to make determinations about whether treatment is needed, sex offender or chemical dependency treatment. And our goal is to make sure that while inmates are in our system, that they are positively programmed. Because if they are idle in our facilities, that's cause for trouble. Violence comes from that, and mischief and all kinds of issues occur. So I'm going to just turn it over to Nan Larson at this point, our behavioral health director, and she'll provide a little bit of information about mental health services.
Ms. Larson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Nanette Larson. I'm the Health Services Director for the department, and I know some of you are very familiar with the mental health services that we provide at our institutions, so I'll give you kind of a very high-level overview. I think Kathleen has also provided to you our backgrounder, and if not, we'll certainly make that available to you. But having listened to some of the previous testifiers, the one thing about the Department of Corrections is we don't get to choose who comes to us. We have to take whoever the courts send to us. So if the courts have deemed that somebody is competent and should be held accountable for their crime, we get to take them. Probably 25% of our adult males and 65% of our adult females utilize mental health services in the Department of Corrections. And we are very fortunate that we have resources. You all have been very generous to us in the past and have given us many of the resources that we need to provide good mental health care. We use a continuum of services, everything from self-help groups and group therapy and individual therapy to residential treatment. We have had the opportunity as well to partner with our sister agency, the Department of Human Services, if we need a level of care that we can't provide within our own agency. Our offenders don't have to pay a copayment for mental health services. They can be referred by any one of our officers, by one of our nursing staff, by one of our mental health staff, and they don't have to pay a copayment for mental health services. As I mentioned, we have a continuum of services. Level one is what we consider to be kind of those self-help groups. Level two would be some of those outpatient or psychoeducational. We have what we call supportive living services at most of our institutions and at every custody level, which is a more supportive living area where mentors help the offenders make sure that they take their medications, that they get up in the morning and shower, that they get to work when they need to, that they get to chow when they're supposed to be going. And then, of course, we have our residential level of care at our mental health unit at Oak Park Heights. It's a 47-bed unit that provides mental health services for the acutely mentally ill, the chronically mentally ill, those who need medication management, those who might be going through a psychotic period of time. We also provide release planning, and I heard somebody, I think the Ramsey County Sheriff, talking about release planning services. We have release planners who focus their services in, specifically to our severely and persistently mentally ill population, and probably 6 to 7% of our population could be categorized as severely and persistently mentally ill. Release planning is integral to successful reintegration into the community. Our release planners focus on everything from setting up community appointments with psychiatrists, ensuring that they have a good supply of their medications that they might be on with us, housing, employment, clothing is a big deal. But then Deputy Commissioner Berry also talked about the housing issue. And imagine, you know, coming out of prison and you're a level two sex offender and you have a felony offense history. Nobody's going to take you. Yeah, and mental health issues. Right. We're not going to be able to find a place for somebody like that to live. And that is becoming more and more and more of a problem. We see offenders who are being released on their supervised release date, and they don't have any place to live, and they get revoked, and they have to come back and spend more time in prison. And so then what do we do with them upon expiration? So the community resources is a huge issue for us. We also provide chemical dependency treatment and sex offender treatment to this population. Of course, those who have mental illnesses and chemical dependency issues is going to be compounded, but we're fortunate enough that we have a co-occurring disorder treatment program. And I think I will stop at that and answer any questions if you have them. Thank you.
Any questions from the members? Senator Limmer?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a question just on your last comment. And tell me what happens to a resident that finally gets to his expiration date. What, do you just open the gate and let him walk out?
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, I have the release planners don't like to do that at all. There have been times that we've had to dump somebody, and I use the term dump purposefully, at the emergency room, because they're mentally ill, we don't have a place for them to go. And that's not the best plan at all. We have been fortunate that we're able to cobble together maybe some home health services with some corporate foster, foster homes. But it's really, really, really hard to find places for these guys to go, or women to go. Mm-hmm.
Central Limit.
Could some of these individuals be subject to a parole and then have some type of supervision? Or am I confusing expiration date with their last date of commuting their sentence? Yes.
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, expiration really means the end of their obligation to us.
And that would happen in the event that there's no place for this individual to go. You have to hold him in a... Is it a medium or a maximum security facility?
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, we would only bring them back if they were released on supervised release and then still had an obligation to the commissioner. At expiration, we don't have that ability to bring them back. And depending on where they would, you know, what level of care they need would depend on where they would go, which institution.
Madam Chair,
and we can certainly talk more.
Senator,
yeah, Madam Chair, we're having the same conversation regarding sex offender, those that are involved in the civil commitment side of things. And everyone understands the concern and often the fear of what do you do with these individuals with a civil commitment. This type of offender that you're talking about perhaps was assessed, but was not assessed to the degree that a civil commitment would be necessitated. And so the Department of Corrections holds on to them for the court-ordered incarceration. And if there's no place to go, eventually an expiration date will come about. And based on other circumstances or other observations, is there another attempt to seek a civil commitment on these individuals?
Ms. Larson?
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, oftentimes, yes. We look at whether or not they can be civilly committed, but again, civilly committed as mentally ill, but that bar is such that, you know, if they're doing well on their medication and they're compliant, but they have this felony offense history and a mental illness history, it's going to be tough to find placement or tough to make that commitment bar.
Thank you.
Thank you. I just wanted to make mention of what you said on barely mentioned here, but needs more discussion too, is the co-occurring illnesses. I know that makes it even more difficult, and sometimes it does because the units are divided in government. You know, there's chemical dependency treatment, there's mental health treatment, and there's other, a couple or three diagnoses for mental health, and it certainly complicates mental health with chemical dependency treatment. So, you know, anybody that wants to discuss that and what's needed in that area too, because I know there's not enough crossover, and I know these are the most difficult people to treat. I also wanted to, if anybody wants to talk about the contract issue, the contracting entities that you use for people to community services, I heard this morning from someone that in one of the treatment centers that's being used, one of the people wrote a poem, a sexually explicit poem about one of the nurses, and they got kicked out of the treatment center. And so, you know, I'm concerned that we're not writing the contracts, the public entity is not writing the contracts to be more inclusive, because if that's such an offense that you'd get kicked out on it when you have a mental health issue, then I'm not quite sure what they would be able to successfully treat. So I think we need to all talk about that, what's going on in the nonprofit and the for-profit treatment sectors too. I know, with, as you said, you have to take anybody that comes in the door. The privates don't. And so the only control we really have over them is through the contracts that we write with those entities to make sure that they aren't going to easily throw them out on the street or whatever if something within the normal range of abnormal, let's say, comes up. And so just want any, if anybody wants to talk about those two issues, I'd be happy to hear about those two. Thank you very much, and thank you to our line staff who works with this every day, and it's a very important job. Thank you for your work.
Thank you for having us today.
Next on the agenda is Carol Roberts, Director of Ramsey County Community Corrections, Nirja Singh, Treatment Director for Ramsey County, Roxanne Sanderson, Mental Health Services Supervisor for Ramsey County Correctional. I guess you can all come up here, and then you can decide which order you want to go in.
Good Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Senators. I am Carol Roberts, and I am the Director of Ramsey County Community Corrections. And Senator Goodwin, let me just say that thank you so much for your visit to our Ramsey County Correctional Facility last week. We really thought it was really beneficial for both of us.
Thank you. Thank you for your time in that, too.
We are Community Corrections Act County with responsibility for the supervision of juvenile and adult offenders and the operation of two juvenile institutions, one a treatment center and one a detention center, as well as a facility that houses sentenced adult offenders. My job today, I think, is pretty straightforward and simple. It's to set the stage for my colleagues to speak to you about our journey in Ramsey County. But part of that journey and story involves what you've heard before, the recognition of the challenge that mentally ill individuals, often undiagnosed, present to the safety of a correctional institution, both to themselves and to the staff. Ramsey County began a transition and a transformation over 10 years ago from a department that had an overwhelmingly singular approach to the treatment of individuals. Basically, it was a correctional response to all problems. To the management of those inmates, to one that emphasized and relies heavily upon the quality of mental health training for staff and the adoption of management strategies heavily laced and informed by the presence of mental health practitioners. I think you've heard from people before me, particularly from the Department of Corrections, they spoke about CIT training. Well, it's moving from a very rigid correctional response and recognizing when you need to use something different to create a more stable institution. It's also a story that has put into place a triage strategy that has led to more effective early identification of mental health issues, a process of assessment, and differential treatment. While I believe that we have come many miles on a shoestring and under very difficult circumstances, there are significant pieces of the treatment puzzle that are often in jeopardy and missing, and their absence really jeopardizes the significant investment that counties have, like Ramsey, have made in identifying and treating these individuals. I think you've heard something about the nature of transitional services. Places like Ramsey and the inmates that we have that have mental health issues, they work with a very dedicated staff to do what needs to be done to get themselves to a better place. So they've made an investment, the county has made an investment, and when they leave, the services that they need to hook up with in the community are often not there. Right, and that is key, and that leads very often to a return to the correctional institution. And one last thing that I would want to say to you is that I really am very proud of the superintendent, assistant superintendent, and our professional staff, because this requires a very flexible approach to mental health issues. You made allusion to before that some services are drug treatment services, substance use services, and some are mental health services. What these folks have done is to remain incredibly flexible. We have no authority over some of these people who leave our institution, but because the staff is so committed and the people are in such need, very often, it has happened, I shouldn't say very often, but it has happened often enough that our staff has actually followed those folks into the community to make sure that things happen. You can't do that unless you are extremely flexible and are willing to work well outside the box to get done what needs to be done from a very common sense approach. Some information for you before I turn this over to our staff. I want you to know that 52% of our adolescents in our two institutions are on medication.
I would like you to repeat that because that's significant.
52% of our adolescents in our two juvenile institutions are on psychotropic medications. In 2013 alone, We had 90 youth in our juvenile detention center who were at high risk for engaging in self-harming behaviors. When we had a second chance grant program at our adult correctional institution, the one that you visited, which was targeted at individuals who are likely to be homeless, who possibly had mental health and substance abuse issues, we found that fully 60% of those people were seriously and persistently mentally ill, but were undiagnosed until that point in time.
I'm sorry, what percentage?
Over 60%. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the issues are there whether we choose to recognize them or not, and sometimes we, or particularly the community, experience the often tragic aftermath of undiagnosed, untreated individuals. I'm now going to introduce you to two very important people, first of whom is Roxanne Sanderson, sitting at my left, who is head of the mental health unit at the Ramsey County Correctional Facility. Roxanne.
Hello, Madam Chair and committee members. Again, I'm Roxanne Sanderson. Thank you for having us here today. A little bit about myself. I've worked at the facility now. It'll be 5 years in January, and then I worked as a probation officer for about 16 years before. So I wanted to say that having this opportunity to work in the facility providing mental health services was a very unique opportunity, just as Director Roberts had mentioned. First time in my career that I've been able to utilize both the clinical background and my probation background. And I wanted to give you a kind of a profile of the offenders that we house.
Good. Thank you.
I'm pulling data from 2012, and during that year we served and housed 4,811 inmates. It's important to note that their average length of stay for the men is 41 days, and the average length for females is 22. The reason why the women's length of stay is so much shorter is that we currently hold a contract with Dakota County for both pre-trial and post-trial inmates. So that's why that number is a little skewed. We house 63% males and 37% females in our population. And the racial makeup is 43% Caucasian, 37% African American, 5.5% Asian, 6% Hispanic, 5.5% Native American, and 3% that's not identified. The committee had asked what the offense level makeup was, and so I pulled those numbers from 2012. 34% of our inmates are being housed there on a felony case, and they can be housed for two different cases at the same time, so there is some crossover there. 30% gross misdemeanor and 23% misdemeanor, and then about 19% haven't been sentenced yet, or they're serving interim sentences. We also asked about what the offense makeup was, and 26% of the population in 2012 was domestic violence-related offenses. So they were there serving a probation violation or sentenced on that type of offense. 20% were there for DWIs or alcohol-related offenses. 10% were drug-related. 17% were theft-related, and then the remaining were about all around 4%, making up the remaining 25%. To give you a little profile of the people we served, I know that you were out there visiting, but I had pulled some numbers, and we, the mental health services, we have two ways of addressing the mental health issues. We have a group of mental health services staff that are clinicians, that are licensed independent clinical social workers, and licensed professional clinical counselors. And we also have a public health staff that treat and see the clients for medications with a contracted psychiatrist that she only works about 5 hours a week. And we pulled some numbers for who we served in 2012. The mental health staff worked with 1,480 clients that year. And some of it's crossover. We pulled numbers, about 250 clients were on what we call high observation status, and that means when a client comes into custody and they're having suicidal ideation or have a history of attempting suicide, we put them on a 15-minute check, and we make sure that the right things are in place to make sure they're safe and monitored. Mental health staff see every one of those clients. And I use clients and inmates interchangeably. We served over 629 individual clients, so we are doing individual interventions with those folks. And we also served another 420 clients in a group setting. And then there's a miscellaneous group that we follow. If there's a consultation question or an inmate or client would send us a kite, we would follow up that way. Again, we wouldn't be able to offer this level of service and continuum of care without the staff that we have. We have, at present, we have two full-time staff in the facility. And as we noted to you before, we have one staff in the field that provides transition care. We also have a case aide that helps us with transitioning clients to the community, and he also does our intakes for us so that the hours from the clinical staff can be best utilized. I think that the other piece I wanted to mention was the psychiatric clinic. You know, she's only there, Dr. Prowse is only there about 5 hours a week. But in 2012, she served 800 clients face-to-face. And then she also checked on another 1,464 chart checks, and that's per occurrence. So that means that close to probably about 40% of our inmates are on psychotropic drugs. She isn't able to see all of them face-to-face, especially if they come in with a prescription. And we are unable to see all of them also because of our staff limitations. But overall, we do see about 31% of our population. I think...
Excuse me. Could you just tell me what percentage of the staff in general, or maybe one of the others, has had CIT?
Oh.
Do you know what percentage of, basically...
You know, all of our mental health staff have been trained.
Yes.
As far as the corrections officers.
Yeah.
I think.
All of the corrections officers.
Yeah, okay.
And all of the correction officers. Thank you.
Yes, all of the corrections officers. We also started this year with the help of funding from our director to start training all the probation officers in the shorter version, the CIP, so that's crisis intervention partners. So probation officers in the field were trained in some of this same dynamic.
Thank you.
I think, you know, being on the front end of this, meeting some of these clients that have never been treated before, I think it's really important to note that many of our clients have never received mental health treatment or interventions, and so we're really teaching them how to navigate the service. So if I were to make some recommendations to you today, I would highly recommend that there'd be some funding set up for there to be mandated services in every jail. We, again, are not able to provide this level of screening. We screen right now, but we would love to be able to do assessments at a higher level, so what we call a diagnostic assessment, and that would help us be able to refer clients to appropriate care upon release. There is a lag time between when someone's in custody with us and when they can get in for an appointment, and staff work really hard to close that gap, but in some cases they won't take it until the assessment's done. We don't have the staff to do that, so we would recommend that there be some clinical positions in all Minnesota jails. The other thing, and Director Roberts noted this, that about the Effective Transitions Grant, that was a grant that was in place from 2011 to April of this year, and we've tried hard to continue to collaborate with the staff that were involved in that grant. It's difficult to They're only able to come maybe one day a week, whereas before with the monies from that grant, we were able to see them be in the facility about 20 hours a week to build those relationships with our mentally ill offenders and help them transition to the outside.
And so can you tell me, was that state or federal money?
That was a second, I believe it was federal money from the Second Chance.
And that's been eliminated altogether?
Yes. The funding for that ended, madam, in April of 2013. So related to that, increasing the services and staff positions to help mentally ill transfer out of jail is very, very important. I think that, you know, we have the opportunity to do some follow-through in our county with flexibility from our management, but it's not always the case everywhere you look in Minnesota. The clients, again, it's been their first time with a mental illness and getting treatment, and they learn to trust us, and so when we transition with them to the community, keeping in contact and keeping that support system in place. The third recommendation I would make is in regards to psychiatric care. In Ramsey County, we have an urgent care that is able to treat clients, much like an urgent care would be for any medical reason. And they're only able to serve so many clients. I unfortunately don't have those stats with me today, but when we have clients able to access that kind of services, they can stay on medications. We do our best at our facility to get them stable on medications, and they leave with 2 weeks and then a 4-week prescription. But then after that, we don't necessarily know if they stay on those medications or if they're able to secure care with a psychiatric provider. And that was all I had.
Thank you. And we have two more. Either one of you want to testify?
I'm going to introduce my colleague on my right, your left, Dr. Neerja Sin, who is the head of, she's a psychologist, and she's the program director at our two juvenile facilities.
Thank you.
Thank you, Director Roberts. Madam Chair and committee members, thanks a lot for having me here to share my observations and experience regarding this very important issue that we are facing in our juvenile institutions. As Director Roberts pointed out, over the course of years, our juvenile institutions, both Boys Totem Town and Juvenile Detention Center, seem like surrogate mental hospitals to me. As she mentioned, we have 52% of children as of last week who are on serious psychotropic medication for numerous mental health issues ranging from mood disorders like depression, anxiety, to serious trauma issues like PTSD. We are seeing more and more children with fetal alcohol syndrome, brain injuries, traumatic brain injuries, and bipolar issues. We are facing some issues with our children showing some signs of psychotic disorders like reporting hallucinations and delusions, which was never the case 5 years ago. A substantial number of our children, almost 70% as of today, have reported experiencing serious abuse in their past life before coming to us. It's 70% as of today. 65% of our kids today in our institutions have IEPs, individualized education plans for emotional behavioral disturbances, so they are on special ed status when they come to us. Another concerning pattern that we are seeing is that law for correctional institutions for a lot of these kids have become a revolving door. So in 2009 and 2010, 64% of the children who graduated from our institutions successfully were back in placements within 6 months of their discharge. So we have initiated a very small research project just to find out what's going wrong. One hypothesis that is getting a lot of support is that at the time of their discharge, these children had mental health diagnosis and a plan of care which was never followed up in the community. But we won't have data to support it until next 3 months or so. So when I was asked to come up with three most important recommendations that would really help the situation, I thought, are we really considering mental health at three phases of institutional placements? That is, pre-placement decisions, are the courts well aware, the judge who is deciding about this child's life, that's going to impact him, his or her life, or and his family and the community, do the judges have every possible information regarding their mental health status at the time of disposition hearing? I don't know. A lot of these kids who are placed on psychotropic medications, these 52%, this was the first time that they saw a psychiatrist or a psychologist within our care. This was the first time, and they are 16 or 17 years of age. And I don't want to comment on how much their mental illness is contributing to their offensive behavior, but I would, with your permission, I would just like to tell you a story. So we have this child. He's 16, serious felony level offense, serious felony level offense, failed numerous placements, has been in and out of foster care all his life. So here he comes to Boys Totem Town, and we start exploring, our treatment team start exploring, you know, what went wrong, what is happening. I don't know what happened. I'm not saying we do an amazing job, but somehow that child connected. And all of a sudden we find out this story, that when he was 11 and he had a sibling, 9-year-old, a male sibling and a female sibling, 6-year-old, mom was murdered right in front of their eyes by an abusive boyfriend. And these children, these three children, committee members, stayed with this mom, the dead body, for 2 days until the police found. And this child tells me, with no emotion, you know what? We ate frozen peas from the fridge. There was nothing else to eat. So I get stomachache when I see frozen peas, because I remember my mom's dead body and three of us sitting and eating frozen peas for 2 days until the police found us. And this is a child who has numerous felonies, numerous issues, failed placements. He has a grandma, the only source of support, who is 85 years old now. I don't know how well she will be able to manage. So this is just an example. And I was thinking, when this child went to court, did the judge have a clinician at his or her disposal who would consult with the judge and say, you know what, I don't know how much this means to you, but there's a chance that he is reenacting the serious trauma he suffered when he is committing all these offenses. This is not an excuse for these children. I'm not saying that. But we have to consider. We have to consider. There is something wrong in their past, whether they have been traumatized or their moms did drugs when they were pregnant. So that cerebral cortex portion of their brain, which has every reasoning and logic, it's missing. It is totally missing. So when we are asking these children to follow rules and abide by the conditions of probation, that part of the brain where all this information is registering, it's not existing. And nobody knows. The judge who is deciding on probation violations, or the probation officer who is dealing with this child in the community, or the placement providers like us, we don't know. So my recommendation would be, if somehow our judges, our courts, have access to this information, and if you have clinical experts sitting in the court in the advisory capacity to the judge and the probation, talking about this child's mental health status, that would really, really help. That would really, really help. Other piece, committee members, I would really want to emphasize, especially when we deal with children, is we are dealing with a family. We are dealing with a unit. And we do great job. I would just say that. We do a great job in institutions providing mental health care, providing family therapy, doing everything. But if we are not empowering these parents, if they are not part of this system of interventions, there is nothing we can do. Because you know what? Eventually, that child is going to go to the parents. So if these parents are not on board and they are not feeling empowered, no matter how great interventions we have in our institutions, it's not going to help. And then this child is a product of a system which has its own issues. In 2012, we had Husky and Associates, and if you have questions, Director Roberts can answer on that. But this group did a file analysis on BTT clients, and they found out that more than 46% of the parents of the clients at BTT had serious trauma-related disorders. So more than 46% of these moms and dads or grandmas or uncles and aunts who were caretakers had experienced victimization in their own life in the past. 50% of these parents have serious, serious chemical dependency issues for which they never received treatment. They never received treatment. 43% of these parents were involved with criminal justice system, the adult system that my friend Roxanne deals with. But with all that, with all the discrimination, with all the poverty that these families face, here is the good news. These parents are asking for help. They want to collaborate. They really want to join hands with us in the system, and they really want their children to be healthy and safe. And why do I say that? I'm saying that based on numbers. Over the last 2 years, we have had 75% of parents actively participating in family therapy at Boys Chatham Town. They are coming. They are asking for help. They are telling us, you know what I am lacking. I need help, which is a very good news. And we come up with all these great plans, but the moment they leave, those plans fall apart. Because these parents have no way to navigate the system. Either they are scared, or they are discriminated, or they are mentally ill themselves. They don't know. And they are too scared of being judged as bad parents and fear of losing their children. Because again, 70% of our parents have had child protection involvement in the past. So they are scared. So what I'm asking is, if we could have some care coordinator who would start working with these parents the moment their child walks into our care and works with these parents, develops solid relationship, and this care coordinator is a culturally competent person who speaks their language, who understands who they are, who can really ask, tell me about your vision of mental health. Because a lot of these parents, there are cultural connotations to mental health. We get a lot of resistance from parents for psychotropic medication because they don't know what we are talking. So if we could have these solid care coordinators who would start working with the family the moment their child walks in our care and follow them, so their child does not have to end up in that 64% of kids who are placed out of home in 6 months of their successful discharge from our institution. So if we could create that system, that will be great. And third, the last one is, if we could have solid mental health services out in the community, so that these children really do not have to commit an offense to get the services they need. So we do great screening. We have mental health experts sitting in the court having a say in the placement decisions. Which placement does this kid go? What is the best possible service he needs? And then during his or her placement, we have these care coordinators who work with the family and work with the kids, and we transition them out. And when they go out, there are a variety of services. So you see the care, the provision is everywhere. We really don't have to wait for these kids to knock at the door of corrections and be another adult offender before getting those services. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Sorry, I forgot your name, and I just met you.
My name is Ron Berge, the assistant superintendent at the correctional facility, Madam Chair and committee members. And take this opportunity to thank you, Madam Chair, for coming to our correctional facility and spending half a day to see firsthand exactly what we are talking about today and the types of offenders and clients that we have to work with on a daily basis who have these tremendous needs. I think Director Roberts and our mental health supervisors here have pretty comprehensively covered what we're talking about, but I would like to just re-emphasize something that we learned through our effective transition grant, the Second Chance Federal Justice Grant, and that was staggering to me. I mean, and I've been in corrections for 38 years, and that has really stuck with me, that this was a grant for homeless, chemical dependent, and mentally ill, and having been incarcerated. Because we had the services and because the grant allowed us the resources and the time, we were able to complete diagnostic assessment. And because of that, we learned that over 60% of the population that we worked with had serious persistent mental illness. And I think it's important to say that these 60% were what we call frequent users of the system. That means our detox, our hospitals, our jails, in and out of our correctional facility on a regular basis. And we were not able to previously diagnose them. That's because we are jails and we are correctional facilities, and we're not equipped across the board to deal with the numbers that have been testified today that come in with mental health issues. And I think it's important to understand that because they are frequent users of the system and they continue to come in, they have had these interventions with corrections, and it's not always a type of relationship that they believe they can trust and that they can come forth and say, I have these mental health issues. I need help. Take the time to get a diagnostic assessment. The model of that program was that case managers, intensive case manager service, was assigned to these inmates, offenders, and clients while they were incarcerated, and the model then was that they would follow them intense transition services for 6 months upon release. We had tremendous success with that program, and it was because there was an advocacy relationship issue that there was a trust and that they felt there is somebody that I know is helping me navigate through the system. And we do create many barriers in our system for just regular inmate populations, and then when we're talking about serious persistent mental health issues, and asking them to do these forms and make appointments for people that they don't have never met before, those are critical. So Roxanne had testified about how we have changed our level of service at the correctional facility to address transition and how do we help people 30, 60 days. We don't have the resources for that, but there is that. I guess that would be a recommendation that I would add, that there is a tremendous need for resources for the mentally ill leaving our facilities. I think earlier today somebody testified within a matter of hours someone had reoffended. My gut tells me they were saying, help me, I can't do this. Mm-hmm. I've heard some of our offenders say, I feel safe here. It's the first time I felt like my issues have been addressed. I don't want to leave. As a manager of the correctional facility, I feel like we need to do more. And we know that the first 30 days upon transition, upon release, is a critical time period for them to get connected into the community, get the resources that they need. But it takes the funding to do that. And so thank you for the time today and appreciate you listening to me.
Thank you very much for your testimony, too. Any questions for this panel from the members? All right, thank you very much, and thanks again for the wonderful tour of the... I left there with some hope that we could have more of the same in other parts of the system, mental health system. Sue Aberholden with NAMI, thanks for coming.
Thank you. So for the record, Sue Aberholden from NAMI, Minnesota, and I do have a handout if there's a way to get that too. So thank you for the opportunity to talk today about mental health issues in Minnesota's judicial and correctional systems. The first thing I do want to point out, though, is that most people with mental illnesses are not dangerous or violent. Unfortunately, when the focus of any hearing is people with mental illnesses in jails or prisons, people jump to the conclusion that they must be violent criminals. And, of course, as we all know, this isn't true. People with a serious mental illness are more likely to be the victims and not the perpetrators. And many people end up in the criminal justice system because we have a police response to a mental health crisis. You've heard the problems faced by sheriffs in trying to address the needs of people with mental illnesses in jail. You've heard the frustration of judges as to the long periods of time when people with mental illnesses sit in jails waiting to be transferred somewhere else. And yes, you have also read the articles written by Paul McEnroe from the Star Tribune sharing the tragic stories of people with mental illnesses in jails whose symptoms worsened and some who took their own lives. A simplistic solution is to simply call for more hospital beds. But I can tell you that simply adding more beds is not the solution. What you have is a front door and a back door issue. And let me say emphatically that we have known exactly what to do for over a decade. It just hasn't been done. The Criminal Mental Health Justice Project created an incredible blueprint for how to address the issue before you today. It was published in 2002. And yet the recommendations are still relevant today, and in Minnesota, very few of them have been implemented. If you want to stop people entering the criminal justice system, you need to first and foremost have access to a good mental health system. And I want to remind committee members that prior to Minsher, most individual and small group policies not only didn't cover mental health, but they were exempt from mental health parity laws. Prior to Medicaid expansion, people with mental illnesses had to apply numerous times to prove they had a disability in order to qualify for the very program that could pay for their treatment. So there were huge barriers to even having insurance that covered your mental health treatment. We certainly hope that come January 1st, people will have an easier time getting coverage for mental health treatment. Mental health treatment is not just a pill. It's therapy, stable housing, rehabilitation, help with daily activities, a job, a crisis plan, and support from friends and families. Not all of these components are covered by insurance, so we need state and local funding to support them, and I will talk more about those changes later. If we want to divert people from going into jails, we need to have a mental health response to a mental health crisis. Training of police officers is critical because CIT or mental health first aid trained police understand mental illnesses and a crisis along with the resources in their communities. They are far more likely to bring someone to an emergency room than to a jail. We do not mandate any type of intensive training on mental illnesses for our police officers. Mobile crisis teams, and including the mental health urgent care that you heard about in Ramsey County, are another way to divert people from the jails. While additional funds were appropriated last session, we still do not have funding to ensure that there is a mobile team in every single county. And even in the areas that have them, they intervene when there is a crisis and not before. NAMI has countless families calling who have a loved one whose symptoms are reappearing. They know they are decompensating, but the teams don't go out until it's a crisis. NAMI will have a bill ready to be introduced for this next session so that the crisis teams can go out earlier. We would respond to chest pains and not wait until a full-blown heart attack, and we need to do the same thing in mental health. NAMI Minnesota is also looking closely at the process for people who are brought, who are incompetent to stand trial, known as Rule 2001. We have brought together a working group, which includes judges, including Judge Quam, prosecutors, defense attorneys, mental health providers, county social services staff, and representatives from the state's competency restoration programs to look at how the Rule 20 process can be improved and made more efficient. And the group is very close to finalizing some potential legislative recommendations. In addition, the group is exploring how competency restoration could be handled in the community mental health system, including on a voluntary basis. NAMI is concerned about the oversight of health services in jails. Several years ago, you passed legislation requiring jails to conduct mental health screenings, but often that's where it ends, and people are not referred on for diagnostic assessments or necessarily even flagged for being at risk for suicide. We have many stories of families going to the jail with their loved ones' antipsychotic medications, and they're not being accepted. Even when they have the actual prescription, they said no. If they can get someone to listen, they are told that the medication is not on the formulary. And I have to ask, do you really want to change a psychotropic medication while someone is in jail? There is no one to complain to, no one who can make sure the person is getting appropriate and, frankly, ethically necessary mental health care. I do want to say that we applaud the CIT training of jail and corrections staff, and, you know, we think that there should be, frankly, more clinical positions in our jails. We know that mental health courts work, and we have three in our state. If you want people to not return to jails, we need to look at the backdoor strategy as well. We know discharge planning works, but we only have a handful of counties that do this. But the real problem is that the legislature simply has not funded mental health treatment and supports. You did invest a lot of money this past session in the children's mental health system, and for that we are thankful, since we have far too many children with mental illnesses in the juvenile justice system, and half of all adults with a mental illness experience symptoms before the age of 14. But the investments in the adult system have not been increased since 2007. So let's take ARMS, Adult Rehab Mental Health Services. They provide rehab services in the home, but we have lost providers because the payment rate is so low that they're only being reimbursed for about 70% of the cost of what we require them to do. This session, you decided that, yes, those rates needed to be increased by about 30%, but how did you fund it? By taking away money from the Adult Mental Health Initiative grants that fund things like supportive housing on the county level. So we robbed Peter, frankly, to pay for Paul. And let's take ERTS. They're the short-term, more intensive residential option, much cheaper than a hospital. But they all have long waiting lists, and we haven't funded them with high enough rates so that they can care for people with aggressive behaviors or other medical conditions. Any new developments must be contracted through the counties, and while providers are willing to build new ones, counties are not willing to approve them. The original funding for ERTS came from, yes, the Adult Mental Health Initiative Fund. And let's talk about how we otherwise support people with serious mental illnesses in the community, corporate foster homes. We put people with serious mental illnesses into places where the staff largely have no training on mental illnesses and where they sit all day 24/7 without treatment and without any focus on recovery. Personal Care Assistant Services, which now have a new name, when the recession hit, the legislature decided to restrict access and limit hours. Eligibility was changed to largely restrict people with mental illnesses from accessing it, and if they were lucky enough to stay on, they get 15 minutes a day. The CADI waiver. We have waivers for every group, developmental disabilities, brain injuries, medically fragile, elderly, and physical disabilities, but not mental illness. So we tried to use the CADI waiver. Again, changes were made to the eligibility criteria, and you even adopted rates, reduced rates for low-needs folks, and those losers, frankly, were people with mental illnesses. People couldn't even leave Anoka because they couldn't get a CADI waiver anymore. And what we've learned recently is that very few people leave Anoka Metro Regional Treatment Center and go home. They go to some other facility, and so that tells me that there's something wrong there. And then there's housing. Affordable housing is key to recovery, but it's hard to find an apartment when you're living on about $600 a month. Section 8 is impossible to get on. And the Bridges program, which is essentially a Section 8 program for people with mental illnesses, has incredibly long waiting lists. Despite your adding money this last session, people are now being told that they can't access it unless they are actually leaving Anoka. Funds for supportive housing have largely come from the Adult Mental Health Initiative grants, but again, those dollars have been reduced.
Excuse me a minute, Sue. The Bridges program you talked about, what did you say the criteria? Are they telling people what that is?
Senator Goodwin, what they're saying is that unless you're coming out of Anoka, you cannot access the Bridges funding, which kind of defeats the whole purpose of preventing people from having to get there in the first place. Also, many people in jail have dual disorders, substance use disorders, and mental illnesses, and yet we have very few programs that treat both using an evidence-based practice. Just last week, I received a call from a mom whose son was just put back into jail. He was sent to a chemical dependency program that required him to go off his ADHD medication, and when he couldn't focus in groups, then they kicked him out of the program, so now he's violating his probation, so now he's back in jail. Last session, NAMI had a proposal to fund intensive early intervention when someone is experiencing their first psychotic episode. If you go to your doctor and she tells you you have cancer, she doesn't tell you to come back when you hit stage 4, but that's what we do in the mental health system. We wait until someone has been hospitalized over and over and over again before we even offer a case manager. First episode programs actually change the trajectory of that young person's life and make sure that the mental illness doesn't become disabling. And then what if a person has no insight or they're a danger to themselves or others or can't care for themselves? We have 87 different interpretations of the Commitment Act, and virtually no county uses the early intervention statute. Every week, I personally take calls, especially on the weekends, from parents whose adult son or daughter clearly meets the commitment standard, and their requests are shrugged off. We need an online training program that clearly explains the commitment law, a training that's developed by DHS, the Ombudsman, advocacy organization, county attorneys, and public defenders that everyone across the state could access. I'm sorry if I'm coming off maybe a little more angry than usual or less grateful, but I've been with NAMI now for 12 years, and our organization has worked exceedingly hard to try to build the mental health system. I've spoken at numerous hearings as to why 70% of the youth in our juvenile justice system have one or more mental health diagnoses, and to why sometimes as high as 60% of the people in our jails have a mental illness. And I tell you every time exactly what needs to be done, but usually only one small piece gets adopted. The recommended solutions haven't changed for years. I just hope that the legislature's answer will. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Aberholm. any questions from the members? I just want to say that it has made a difference with you being at NAMI, and certainly in the last 12 years, even though we haven't put the state funds towards it, you have really brought about a lot of recognition on the issues surrounding mental illness and really done a lot in the way of promoting training and other things. So your job, as difficult as it is, you've done extremely well considering the circumstances. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
Our last scheduled testifier is Glenn Anderson and Karen Johnston. And very sorry to keep you waiting this long. I guess I should have
asked earlier if you needed to get out of here because you are traveling down from Brainerd or Bemidji, didn't you? Not? Am I wrong about that? Northern Pines? Brainerd. Okay, thank you. Okay, yes, please, welcome in and go in whatever order you would like.
We'll start this direction, Madam Chair, committee. My name is Karen Johnston, and I'm the Executive Director of Tasks Unlimited in Minneapolis, and I want to thank Sue and my other community colleagues for testifying today on this very difficult problem. But we've heard many times today that there are no community programs that address this problem, and I'm here to tell you that we are the community program that addresses this problem. Tasks Unlimited has been in operation for over 40 years, and we work with people with serious and persistent mental illness, and we provide housing and mental health support and jobs. Last year, I gave a 40-year job award to someone with serious and persistent mental illness. We have a number of county and federal contracts. We run our own janitorial services company, which has over $5 million in revenue. And we would love, and I repeat, love, to clean some of the state buildings and provide jobs to some of our folks. I'm not shameful and for the commercial. Tasks works with what is called the Fairweather model. The Fairweather model is an interdependent model where clients help each other. Clients help each other on the work sites, in the lodges where they live, and in their daily lives. We have three training programs, one of which Sue just mentioned. It's an IRTS program, an Intensive Residential Treatment Services program, that was started 7 years ago with the help of former Senator Linda Berglund. Senator Berglund put some legislation together that gave us some additional funding, and she also arranged for jobs at Oak Park Heights Prison so that our clients had jobs. Those jobs have been taken away with the economic cutbacks, and the funding for the IRTS program has been cut every year for the last seven. We were given a budget 3 weeks ago, and just last Thursday afternoon, we were told that was going to be cut an additional 5%, thereby putting this very small program in jeopardy after the 2014 budget cycle. We are a small program. We only have six beds. We've been told that the issue is economy of scale. Larger programs get a higher funding level. We believe that working with folks coming out of the prison system with serious and persistent mental illness takes more intensive services, and it's more efficient and effective for us to work with smaller groups. We also don't care to go through a variance or a conditional use hearing with our neighbors in Edina. Those generally aren't looked at real favorably. We've never had any problems with our neighbors. Our neighbors have been extremely supportive. We just don't care to go down that road. Tasks is extremely successful. Our recidivism rate back to the hospital for a client that is in the program is less than 1%. People that are in the Tasks program stay in the Tasks program. As I said earlier, we have clients that have been in the program 40 years and have been working all of those years. The day, the very day that a person comes into the task program, they start working. We help with independent living skills. We work with vocational skills. We work with socialization skills. And we help people learn to reintegrate back into the community. I'm not going to go into a lot of the statistics that my community colleagues went into because you've heard them. But I do want to emphasize the point that all of the departments in the state really need to work together. There are programs like ours that are providing these services that work with people with serious and persistent mental illness, with criminal backgrounds. We work very, very well with the folks at St. Peter and have worked with some of the toughest patients that they've had. We've worked with some very difficult patients coming out of the prison system, Stillwater, Shakopee, Oak Park Heights, St. Cloud, and are very successful. But we need the funding to do that. We need the IRTS rates to be more fair and equitable. We need the Department of Human Services to be working with the Department of Corrections. And we believe that, by doing that, we can help really solve some of these issues. Now, it's easy for you to, for me to sit up here and give a commercial for tax, but before I introduce a gentleman beside me, I'd like to offer all of you tours of Interlochen, which is our program that serves folks with criminal backgrounds and mental illness. Senator Ortman has visited the program, as have another number of other legislators. We're very proud of the program, and our clients are very proud of the program. And contrary to some popular belief, people don't want to sit home doing nothing. They don't want to sit with just taking state checks. Our folks give up their benefits quite often because their jobs pay them enough to live like the rest of us live. Jobs are important to us. Jobs are important to these folks as well. So before I bore you now with any more of a my tale, I'd like to introduce to you Mr. Willie Brown, sitting on my left. He's a TASCS client, an Interlochen graduate, who graduated Interlochen over 2 years ago. He moved into one of our lodges, and then moved to an apartment on his own. Willie is on our Interlochen Board of Directors as the vice chair, and he also mentors his time with new clients in Interlochen who struggle with the newfound freedoms that our community programs offer after incarceration. And with that, I'll introduce Willie.
Hello.
Hello, Mr. Brown. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. Hello, my name is Willie Brown. I'm here to talk about TASCS Unlimited and my story. TASCS Unlimited has helped many people with mental illness coming out of the criminal justice system. I was incarcerated from December 2008 to March of 2009 for a class one felony. At the time of the incident, my mental illness was not stable. I did not have a job and no stable housing. I was seeing a therapist but was not on the correct medications, and my symptoms of depression were increased. I couldn't focus. I couldn't go on about my daily activities, and I was having hallucinations. When I was in jail, I was taking medications, but there were no opportunities for therapy or mental illness peer support groups. In the Hennepin County Workhouse, my mental health was getting to the point I was so depressed I couldn't sleep. I would stay up for days at a time. I couldn't eat, and I was afraid that others would harm me. When out of jail, I entered into Portland Halfway House until November of 2009. While there, I sought support from Spectrum Programming, who then referred me to TASCS Unlimited. I was accepted into Interlochen on November 9th of 2009. The staff of Interlochen accepted me with open arms and opened their doors for me. At first, I didn't like living with people I didn't know. It took a while for me to feel safe. I often thought about quitting the program, but I didn't quit. It was really tough at first. It was at Interlochen where I got the support I needed for my mental illness. There was 24/7 staff available, stable housing, food, employment, and peer support. At Interlochen, I learned a lot of skills to cope with my mental illness. I graduated from the Interlochen training program in May 2010 and moved into Blue Stars Lodge, where I live with four housemates who also suffer from mental illness. From there, I moved into independent housing with my fiance, Virginia, who is here with me today. On February 1st, 2013, I've been in TASCS Unlimited programming for 4 years, where I haven't been hospitalized, have stayed out of legal trouble, and I maintain my job. I'm also vice president of the Interlochen Board, where I meet with staff every 3 months and speak to current Interlochen residents. My son, dad, and I have a close relationship where previously we did not. I told my son I was going to speak in front of the Senate, and he told me he was proud of me, and that made me proud. I have come a long way since 4 years ago. I would like to see more programs like Task Unlimited and Interlocking for people with mental illness coming from criminal justice system. It's hard to find stable housing and jobs when you have a record along with the mental illness. In jail, I told the nurse I was suffering from mental illness, but they did not offer to help me. They just gave me medication, but they didn't give me the support I needed, like therapy and peer support groups. I would have liked better medication management because the medications I was on didn't help me. I would like to see Task Unlimited programming continue. Again, I've come a long ways, and Interlocking was a stepping stone to my success. Thank you for listening to my story.
Mr. Grant Brown, I just want to congratulate you. You've gone and really done a lot of things to help yourself and with the help of Task Unlimited and others. And congratulations.
Thank you.
Great job. Any questions from Senator Limmer had to leave for another meeting in St. Louis Park. So, Senator Limmer, do you have any questions?
I don't have to leave to.
I know. I hope you don't. Senator Wicklund? Senator Limmer, thank you very much for coming to see
us
today. And
thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. And your son has every right to be proud of you.
Yes.
Yes, sir.
My name is Glenn Anderson. I'm the executive director at Northern Pines Mental Health Center. We serve north central region, including Aitkin, Cass, Crow Wing, Todd, Morrison, and Wadena counties. And I'm here to talk about a program that we have up in our territory that is funded by an Office of Justice Programs grant, and it's a reentry program. It's specifically for people returning from the Department of Corrections or from jails in the region back to their homes in our six-county region. Most of our referrals come from the DOC, and I'm pleased to say that we've worked with every client referred to us by the DOC who has a serious mental illness. Our criteria includes that you have a serious mental illness and you're also returning to your home in the region. So that's a fairly small slice of the 7,000 people that get returned to homes or released that were spoken about earlier. I did a quick kind of horseback statistical analysis while I was waiting, and about 33 people a year are released from the DOC to our six-county region with a serious mental illness. Our current caseload has served, our program has served 32 people so far. So we get essentially everybody referred to us. And what we do is we combine the full range of our mental health center's services with housing support and employment support. And those are really the kind of big three that are strikes against prisoners returning with a serious mental illness. We've discovered that if, well before release, there's some engagement activity, we go to the prison, we meet the client, we meet the discharge planning people, we find out what the problems are going to be, and we have in most cases housing already arranged for when they're released, and shortly after that an employment opportunity, and that combined with access to our mental health services means that the things that are putting our clients at greatest risk are pretty much taken care of. So basically we prepare a soft landing for returning prisoners, and our success rate is extraordinarily high. We've hardly had any people returning to prison, and in almost all of those cases they've been violations that don't involve reoffending, but simply failure to comply with probation requirements. It's been a really interesting adventure for us in terms of building relationships with the DOC and just working together. And Sue said earlier that this isn't something that we don't know how to do. And I'm here, and I think TASS Unlimited is a terrific example of the know-how that actually exists out in the community. What we really lack is the will to implement these services across the board. We're doing a very good job in our region of taking care of people with serious mental illness coming out of prisons and jails. Our next step is to go to the front door and work with the criminal justice system to see what kind of diversions we can offer, because we have a full array of programs. We have assertive community treatment. We have rapid access to psychiatry. In our region, we run the mobile crisis outreach program, and the jails are one of the places that we're willing to go. I understand that here in the metro, the crisis services won't go to the jail, but out in greater Minnesota, it's easy to see that it makes sense for crisis services to be just as available to prisoners in the jail as it is to people in the emergency department or out in the communities. So I guess I'm just trying to make the point that there are solutions. This is not a puzzle. It's more of an implementation problem. And the state is, especially the metro, comparatively under-resourced when it comes to community-based services. You've got a lot more services in the seven-county metro area than the rest of the state combined, but on a per capita basis, the metro is severely under-resourced. And so the good news is that if you're adequately resourced, and I think we pretty much are in my region, you can really do a pretty good job of solving these problems. So I'm really delighted that there's a committee like this that's paying attention to the problem, and it's very heartening to hear people from the law enforcement community and corrections community all at the table together saying we need to solve this problem, and I think they're right.
Thank you. I have a couple questions for you. I've heard, you talked about diversion services. Are you doing diversion services now to keep people out of jail in your area, or is that not part of your program?
We don't have a specific diversion program in place, but what we have done, especially with our crisis services, is developed a relationship with the law enforcement community that is extremely cooperative. And so people who are on the slippery slope to being put in jail often get intervened by our own crisis program. The law enforcement calls us. One of the things that we've done is we've made it clear to every law enforcement agency in the 6th County region that if they call our crisis line any time of the day or night and say, we need you to show up here to deal with a mental health crisis, we'll be there, no questions asked. And what that has kind of meant is that a lot of things that could have devolved into, some kind of an assault offense or some kind of path to jail get intervened. So at the very front end of a mental health crisis, we're providing some intervention. We with the reentry program, we kind of wanted to establish relationships with community corrections and kind of make our bones, if you will, and the next step is for us to reach out to county prosecutors and see what we can provide by way of alternatives to incarceration on the front end. Right now we're working on a pilot project to do alternatives to St. Peter for Rule 20 clients.
Mr. Anderson, I have a couple more questions for you. Do you have, maybe you said this and I didn't hear you, treatment beds?
We don't have any treatment beds. Okay. We are a community mental health center. There are no IRTSs in our region except for two downgraded SOS facilities. The former Community Behavioral Health Hospital in Wadena is now a 16-bed ERTS, and the former CABS unit at Brainerd is now a ERTS for people with closed head injuries. And one of the reasons that we don't really have a lot of residential treatment beds in our community is because other services like sort of community treatment have stepped in and kind of obviated the need for them. We really keep about 75% of the people who otherwise would be hospitalized and kind of run through that system from ever going into the hospital.
Thank you, and I've heard really good things about your program, so I'd like to understand more about it, and if I get a chance to come up there and take a look at it. But I guess, do you aftercare medication management then?
Oh, absolutely,
okay.
Yes.
Okay, that's a big part of what you do, keep people out of the hospital.
What's typically the problem for somebody returning from prison, say, is that their referral will likely be to the county, and the county is tasked with sort of lining up services, and oftentimes what the most you get is maybe an appointment, and then it's up to you to get to the appointment, you know, and we know enough about how things work to realize that you have to do more than just offer some services. You have to build a relationship, and you have to get out in front of it and make sure that your client is going to show up and make sure that they don't fall through the cracks. Those first 72 hours are crucial. Mm-hmm. So we don't let people fail by, you know, just by being very proactive, and that just works really well.
And one final question from me. Do you take juveniles? Are you...
Well, our OJP program is for adults, but we're heavily involved in the school system, and that enables us to intervene there, too, and we are about to launch our Youth Assertive Community Treatment Program, which is going to be specifically for people who are between the ages of 16 and 21, and that will include people who are mixed up with the juvenile justice system.
Thank you very much. Any other questions from anyone? All right. Well, thank you all for coming, and good luck to you, Mr. Brown. Thank you for coming.
Yep.
And I want to know if anybody in the audience that hasn't had a chance to speak would like to speak. Okay. What I'd like to ask is that if, you know, I would like to hear your ideas for at least the one or two most things that you think would be most important to do now. This is a long-term issue, you know. It'll take a few legislative sessions, but I'm bound and determined to get some work done on this issue and even this session if possible. And so, you know, we can't do it all at once, but we really have to keep this going. And I appreciate all the experts in here that came in and testified and gave us all this information today, and I really would like to put some kind of a bill together for this session. I've gotten a lot of good ideas here today, but if you'd write them down and email them to me, that would be even more helpful, because then I can print them out and take a good look at them and talk to our Senate Council staff here to talk about what's plausible and so forth. So please feel free to do that. You too, Mr. Brown, and anybody that lives in your lodge, and that'll work out just fine. So thank you all very much for coming, and thanks again to Mr. McEnroe for bringing this issue to the public, and hopefully we'll keep it in the public eye. I just recently read a book called American Psychosis by E. Torrey Fuller, and it's an excellent, excellent book about the history of mental health services from the state hospitals and the proposals made by John F. Kennedy early in the 60s to now. And this particular book was just finished in June of this year, and it talks about what some of the other states are doing. Unfortunately, it sounds like other states are doing a lot more than we are right now either. But everybody knows what a big issue and a big problem this is. And I'm sure the economy, besides the fact that people don't understand this, don't know how serious this issue has become,
the economy didn't help either, and we've got to stop taking money away from mental health services every time we have some kind of a budget crisis. So I really do appreciate all of your help, and I would be very happy to hear from you. My email address, you can go online and get my home address, my email address, my home phone number, and all that. So feel free to contact me anywhere. Thank you very much for your time. Meeting is adjourned.